Hi, everybody. This is your friend, the Gingerbread Man. I'd like to welcome you back to my home again. We're here to discuss some topics and some ideas, some curiosities and some eccentricities, and hopefully we can all bend our minds just a little bit more today and maybe find out something new. Let's think of it as a quest, shall we? Either way, have you ever considered the separation between you and everybody else? Have you ever thought about the word I, and not the word I-E-Y-E, but the word I that's spelled with just the letter I, I. And I feel like there is a distinction between I and me, even, you know, because when I say me, me is almost a subject. Like, I'm talking about myself as an object in the world. Like, me. Whereas when I say I, I'm speaking more in essence about at least what I feel is this sense of who I am. But before we get too deep, I have a message from our sponsor today. Coming to a store near you. This is a very useful item that everyone needs. All the cool kids get their confidence from this. I can't stress enough how much more interesting your life will start being when you start playing with this thing. Today, we are offering self-identities free of charge. Come pick up yours today. Self-identity. What is the self? What is me? What is I? Are these all just synonyms? Or are they differences for this concept that we've all been trying to figure out for what seems like millennia? At the heart of any philosophy is a discussion of self. There's always a discussion of subjectivity, where subjectivity is how when I see an apple from one side and somebody else sees that same apple from a separate side, we could have different viewpoints of that same apple and be looking at the same object, but subjectively from each of our subjects, we're going to have a different perspective. When I was describing I and me, and I see the I as more of the knowing essence of my ability to describe whoever I am, there's been this concept of the observer, too, that intrinsically ties with this, I feel. Our observations of things is how we build our world. But think about it just inside your own little dome, your own little head for a second. You know, when you have thoughts rolling by like a stream or like a river, you know, or like when if you've ever been in the car and you know when you're just kind of staring blindly out the window and you can see trees and other people and cars and maybe, you know, strange animals just drifting by that window and there's just a stream. And, you know, I kind of think of this as the stream of consciousness. And within that resides all these ideas and all these balloons of feelings, you know. But do you completely identify with this stream of things that are going by you? Or even think of the game Frogger, you know, and all the logs are rolling by and the Frogger has to get through the logs and all the logs are separate ideas. And so Frogger is picking ideas that link together to get across the stream well, you know, just to be able to get any idea accomplished or any effort accomplished. Yet, do you feel like these logs are you, or do you see the separation with the frog and this analogy I'm trying to make? And I might be confusing myself even with this one, but I feel like that there is this essence of me that sees all these thoughts, and I can step away too and watch them go by almost, you know, like I don't even have to play the game. I don't have to jump across the stream. I can merely stand on the shore and watch the thoughts too. And so this idea of this piece that's watching, and that's all it's doing is watching. It's not thinking. It's not producing the thoughts. It's not even really producing the feelings. It's not even choosing the reaction. It's just the watcher, the observer that's watching all these things happening on the inside. And I connect this more closely to the I, you know, whereas don't do that to me. You know, there's almost like an outside agency that I have to be talking to in order to use me. I can't use me when I'm talking about myself, like, unless I'm pitying myself almost. If I'm talking like in a third person way. I don't know. So this space between the individual and the group, or I like to think of it as the collective, you know, the space between one and many. And you can have different groups that could have this, that could operate as individuals, and you could have groups of us and thems too, where you have groups of collectives pulling forward this individual idiosyncrasy that develops when the self tries to defend itself. So what are the jobs? You know, why do we care about even thinking about me's and I's and selves and groups and we's? What is the job of I? Like, what is so important about an I? Like, why would I have this piece of me that operates this way? Why do I have a piece that seems active within me? You know, it's a center of my consciousness. If there was a wheel that, so imagine a wheel here where you have different feelings and ideas and opinions about things, and those are spokes and hubs on your wheel. And then the observer sits at the very center of the wheel, you know, picking which ones to use. If that's a useful analogy. However, it's active because it attaches to things in the first place, because it has opinions about things. It has perspectives and ideas on what to do next. You know, one of the brilliant things about our consciousness is that we can use our past and glimpse what has happened and try to use that to predict a better way to live in the future. And I'm not going to make any judgment calls on whether or not animals or plants could even feel this way, because I have personal conviction that they could, and that even a housefly could plan. But it's so useful, even evolutionarily, it makes sense why we would have this ability to attach to things and like things or dislike things. If we didn't have any sort of motivating factor like that in us, in any creature, it would be hard to live this material existence, or at least seek health, you know, like even to seek food. There's a bit of self-interest that is required to take care of yourself. And so selfishness is always a word that I feel has a lot of weaponized potency to it. You can use selfishness as a way to chastise somebody or even belittle them in a positive or a negative context. Whereas when you are trying to better somebody by calling them selfish, you're trying to tell them to focus on others more. Because so let's bring up this wonderful scale again, my favorite thing, you know, the scale of selfishness today. On one side is minor selfishness, which would be like, hey, I need to eat. So I'm very hungry. I need to take time to eat. That's a very self-centered action. And on the other side of the scale of selfishness would be, you know, just obscene selfishness, where people are willing to hurt others for their own personal satisfaction, even to the degree that it's not even necessary for that satisfaction to happen. Like, you have sadists and you have murderers and you have all these awful, despicable members of society that are using other lives for their own satisfaction and purely just for pleasure. And that would be an insane level of selfishness that I could not condone ever, you know? So my eye knows where I am or what I'm doing, you know? Like, not only can I like or dislike things, my eye knows that I'm sitting in my room right now, surrounded by a ceiling and four walls, and I have my plants in front of me, and I have my pictures on the walls, and my computer, and my entire audio equipment in front of me. My essence of I knows exactly where I am and what I'm surrounded by right now. And if I didn't have a clear concept of that, it would be pretty hard to manage in this physical world as well. My I makes decisions about what I'm going to do, makes decisions about where I'm going. It makes decisions about whether I should feel good or bad about desiring or disliking what's happening to me. And when I make a decision, this can change my action, where all these things that I've been discussing, you know, it could change those benchmarks, and I could find myself in a different place or a different location. If I will it so, if you can even conceive of a difference in what you're doing, which is another question altogether. Then, of course, I have my identity. Who am I? What is my perspective? What is important to me? What do I love? What do I care about? What feels good, whether I desire it or not? You know, sometimes you can have painful stuff like exercise. You know, exercise hurts in the moment, but you feel better about it afterwards. You know, this identity is like a persona. It's like an avatar. It's this thing that I push towards people to express myself. This week I had a trainee in my daycare, and so I guess I've been gaining a bit more esteem in the daycare that I work at, and it's a chainy daycare, so there's lots of them all over the country. There's hundreds, but it's not a bad chain, and I respect it. But they're starting to send me other cooks to come with me so that I can train them, because people like what I'm doing, I guess, or at least it's been spreading around the company a little bit. So I had this guy, and you know, I had such a hard time all week because I haven't worked with somebody else or not been by myself in such a long time, really. It was awkward, weird having somebody there. And we just talked so much and I was so exhausted. And I just caught myself like, you know, not quite bragging, you know, but just speaking about my life. And this guy was like pretty, like, not say wooed, you know, but he was like, oh, that's really cool. I like. And so he just kept giving me like good compliments. And every time it would sicken me, because I don't feel good about those compliments. But it's like I had this old persona that I was used to pushing towards people of competent, whatever. And with people who really know me, that all breaks down. And I'm very wishy-washy, and I'm always going to express exactly what's on my mind. So you get a lot of different perspectives, because I don't have a real clear identity or persona anymore. You know, I try to hold many in the least schizophrenic way possible. You know, yet I was pushing this old competent persona on this guy, and it wasn't me. And that's what he was catching, because I was pushing it out well, because I've always been good at pushing that. That's why I'm good at getting interviews. That's why I'm good at getting jobs, is that I can put on a really good persona of what you want, you know. But that's not me, you know, in a way. I guess I am identifying more than ever with simply the watcher. I see myself as simply as the observer. And all of these ideas, though some of them can be useful, I'm starting to become very, very choosy. And I don't identify with much that goes on in my mind anymore. And so when I'm by myself, that's easy to maintain, because I can just do what I need to do. And it's actually quite pleasant. But meeting new people, I haven't done that in a really long time. And you really get to see how your old patterns and how you express yourself to other people is. And sometimes I'm not very proud of that salesman of myself, that salesman of personality. You know, I'm not quite sure how much I like that person, but that's okay. You know, we all have to build these identities, and we do it by ourselves, whether we realize the influences that are helping us do it or not. You know, there are many influences that affect how you form an identity. You know, you have your friend groups, your family groups, everybody you've been exposed to, even strangers if you've seen trauma or violence. All of these things lead and build. Like, have you ever been in a sand pit? I remember when I was a kid, one of my favorite things to do is I'd take a cup of sand and I'd get a big old cup and then I dump it over, and then you fall and it'll make a little hill on the ground, and you get more sand, you just keep dropping it on top, and over time the hill grows. But it's very, especially once it gets bigger, most of the sand falls to the bottom of this cone, that it's like a volcano cone, you know. And but it's a slow gradual process, but you can end up with this huge, pretty tall pile if you just keep doing one cup at a time, you know. It reminds me of this analogy from the Buddha, where he compared giving love to taking a thimble out of the ocean, like taking a thimble of liquid out of the ocean and dropping it and trying to remove the ocean that way. Like, you can never deplete love. like ever. And we all carry that ocean of love inside of us. You know? Well, anyway, my identity organizes ideas. You know, I make schema. You know, this better helps me make decisions about the who's, the what's, the where's, the why's. You know, and all these organizations and these schemas, they've helped me declutter because I can generalize huge groups of concepts under just, you know, these like umbrella terms, you know, and all these associations, they're all loosely connected in my mind somehow. And this organizing factor is essentially tied to who I am, because my watcher, or maybe not, it's not the watcher. There's some willing force. There's some force of will within me that chooses all these things. And that's part of my identity. And it's part of my eye, you know? It's not all about the observer, I guess. Yeah. Maybe it's a multifaceted, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's okay. I'm going to do my best. My eye has feelings. You know, I can feel the feeling. You know, the feeling of a feeling, you know, because you could be dead sometimes. You could be numb sometimes. And I know we've all been in the point where we know how we should be feeling. Like if you've ever been grieving, you know, that's a great example of grief when you know exactly what's supposed to be going on, or when you're scared, you know, but there could be a wall, a haze between the feeling. But the part that feels the feeling, you know, that's a crucial part. And having a feeling about something, you know, that conviction or opinion or perspective, you know. In the certainty episode that we discussed with Wittgenstein, there's a part of me when I get exposed to any information that gives me a gut reflex, a gut feeling of right or wrong. And that could be ethical, or that could be any sort of base, you know? That's a weird thing that creates that opinion, that conviction towards any feeling or idea. It's weird. And my eye keeps this body alive. You know, without an ego, like if we bring back our scale that we just mentioned on the loose side, the left side of the scale, where people are doing self-interested tasks to keep themselves alive, or maybe even help others. It might not even be with you. You could be selfish to help others. When you do community service, when you give to others, when you do charity, when you donate your time, when you give time to your friends out of love, you know, sometimes it can be a burden-ish, but I think it makes you feel good too. A big reason I want to help people is because it feels really good. The reason I want to make this show, the reason I want to talk to others, the reason I talk to strangers, the reason I try to show compassion is because it feels good. That's selfish. That's a very selfish thing, to feel good, to want to help somebody. But should you feel bad about that? Is that a reason to feel guilty because it feels good to help others? I don't think so. I don't think you completely have to be in a shit pile to be doing good. A lot of the times, living well, there's still going to be struggles and strife, you know? Anyway, let's move along. So that's a lot of the jobs that I would consider for the eyes and the individual, the one, you know? But what are the we's jobs? What does a group do? What does a community do? You know, what is the purpose? Why do we have groups? Why do we bunch together? Why is it so uncomfortable when we're alone? You know, we can be very, very selfish people. You can take the most selfish person and put them alone, and I'm sure that they would be miserable. Even if they only got pleasure from hurting others, if they were in complete isolation, that would drive anyone mad, especially over time. I watched this amazing documentary today about this French guy, I think his name is Joffrey, but he buried himself in a cave for 2 months back in the 60s to do an experiment and see what would happen when somebody wasn't exposed to human contact or light cues, and to see how that they would divide their time. And his brain organized onto a 24-hour clock pretty well, and his sleep cycles would change. Sometimes he'd be up for like 23 hours straight. Sometimes he'd be up for 6 hours and sleep most of the time. But his brain pretty much organized himself onto a one-day schema without light, without all that, which shows that there is a biological clock inert inside of us that does not depend upon contact or any sort of action for us to know when is the right time to sleep or eat or whatever. Like, there is a part of our inside of our body that is talking to us, you know? Anyways, he was completely isolated, is my point. And strange things happened to his concept of time. And strange things happened to his concept of who he was and how much time had passed. When they brought him up, he had thought only a month had passed. So time had stretched for him. And that's just simply not being around anybody. You know, the brain has an amazing way to take care of itself. But when you take a human away from a human, from humans, from society, from strange and not always good things happens to us. And a lot of it can break us, you know. So the we has a community. And within that community, you have support and you can help one another. You know, amazing things happened during the pandemic. You know, I know it was a horrible, horrible time period. And I hope that if anybody's lost anybody out there, I grieve for you and I feel for you. And I hope that you can learn how to live comfortably in life with that loss. And I hope you know you're going to be okay. And that, you know, I'm here for you. We're here for you. You know, everybody's here for you in that grief. But that's what's so fortunate about having that everybody, is because within community, within family, we help each other. And there are some shitty people out there, but most of the time, I think you would be surprised how often people step up to help each other. And it's amazing. You know, and that's because of neighborly love. That's because of group consciousness. That's because of, you have a group consciousness. And within that, there is this layer of the self again that you see, this protective self, the ego within the I. There is a overmind within a group that seeks to protect it. And so when a part of it gets injured, they soothe it. You know, when you cut your finger, you put a Band-Aid on it and you soothe it. When somebody's harmed in your society, you go help them and it feels good. And there's something broken in that society if there is a resistance, and not from the person, but a societal resistance, because the institutions aren't built to let us help each other anymore. And they're pushing us to be less helpful in these artificial, unhuman ways of living. Not helping is not human, you know? Being put under so much pressure that you can't go love somebody else because you're working two jobs and you're struggling to put food on the table is not human. Not having enough places to live for people because we're all so consumed with profit and figuring out how to turn housing into money is not human. Compassion, altruism, care, the ability to go pick up a stranger because they've fallen on the street, or to see somebody sleeping outside on a cold night and to call somebody to go pick them up, like a homeless shelter or something. Having institutions put in place where people can talk and love each other instead of try to make money off each other, that is human. So I want to make a separation here between what I see as a group and the abstract groups that we have in our world nowadays as well. But within the human group, within the, like, consider the tribe, consider the family, you know, and you could have love between tribes. And I know I've mentioned this in other episodes. I don't think warfare was as prevalent as we thought back in tribal society when we didn't have large scale groups of people. You know, I feel like spreading seed and sex was far more likely than war when groups of small groups of humans would meet each other. So love is possible within communities. Love is something that's given. You can have self-love, but the ability, the way I nurture my love and bloom it, because I grow my love inside me, I'm nurturing it. I'm adding spiritual water onto my love roots inside my body so that they continue to get stronger so that I can give it more. And the way that I do that is by giving it and freely giving it when I have the capacity to. And so society allows that. It gives so many opportunities to give somebody little pieces of kindness to show that I see who you are. What is in you is also in me. And I see it and I love it. You know, you could do that with a stranger. You could do that with the gas station attendant. Love spreads. Love is contagious. Love is like a virus. When we start to give it, you smile at somebody, that smile catches. And it keeps spreading too. Love leads to growth, and sometimes unchecked growth leads to the type of large, huge, abstract societies we have nowadays. However, when you have a lot of people working together, you have an amazing ability to build things. Large buildings, large temples, the temples of Giza. I mean, the pyramids of Giza. My apologies, Egyptians. But all of these amazing feats of human ingenuity comes from humans working together and a shit ton of people working together. Even our technology is built upon the technology of the past. All of this infrastructure comes from people working together, comes from people having the capacity to communicate ideas. You know, consider science. The reason that science has such an amazing ability to be able to do what it does is because it checks itself and because it has no borders. Science happens across countries. You have, like, even consider getting to the moon. Even if they were stealing information from each other, the competition between the Soviets and the United States within the scientific competition made that technology happen and made that math happen so that we knew how we could reason ourselves to that space. So do you need millions of people tied together to be able to produce science? Could you have smaller communities loosely tied together by interdependence and love and by trade that could still produce science and technology? I don't think it's impossible, but I might be talking out of my ass. I am biased. Interdependence is crucial. We can't, usually, do everything we need to do for ourselves. There's always some guy out there who's building a cabin living by himself, you know, but it's easier to have trade. It's so much easier to be able to get some things and know somebody else who has it. If you have to gather all the things on your own, you're just going to be a lot more tired. But what is it that I am? I know that's a weird question. Descartes, he always said, cogito, ego, sum. Damn, I didn't write it down. Yeah, cogito, ego, sum. Ego, cogito, sum. Something like that. I don't know. I think I forgot it. But it's some Latin that basically comes out to, I think, therefore I am. And it's a soundbite that I put out quite a bit. I should probably just have a button, like a clicker in my pocket so that I could press it and it could just say it for me. Like, it's a common trope with me. But I think, therefore I am. And he used doubt to get to the bottom of who his essence was. And he looked at the watcher and identified with that over everything else. How do our thoughts feel when we're by ourselves and when we're in a group? You know, groupthink. Do you feel like almost like a telepathy when you're with somebody that you vibe with really, really well? Like, you know, I've always, you know, in the beginning of a really good friendship with somebody, when you're talking and you're just spreading all those stories. And I know I just talked about it with my trainee, but it's awkward in that situation. It was artificial, but I've had very good moments where I met somebody where I'm like, wow, this person is fucking cool. This is such an awesome person. I just want to sit here for hours and just hear about everything they have to say and share as many things as I can. And it's intoxicating. You know, there's a feeling when we're, our thoughts gain different textures, almost woohoo, almost psychically, you know, when we're with a group of people, especially ones we vibe with, you know. And then maybe when you're with a group of people that you are not vibing with, like a lot of people you dislike, your thoughts get real ugly. You know, when I'm with somebody that I dislike to the point that I don't like how they talk to people, how they treat people, and all of a sudden I catch myself almost sponging up their traits. You know, every time I disrespect them or don't treat them with compassion, I'm acting more like them and I've become more like them. So in essence, being in that group with them, you just in that physical space affects me. This makes me think about these thoughts again, the stream that's flowing by with all the logs. All the logs are filled with chipmunks of ideas and thoughts, you know. I don't know. Maybe they're like canoes rolling down the stream, just full of various colored boxes. I don't know. I'm going to visualize it in a whole bunch of different ways. Maybe it's a barge with a shit ton of flowers of all kinds of different colors growing out of the soil. You know, that one's pretty. The next one comes by and it's a barge full of garbage. You know, the pretty one is no less real than the garbage, but both could affect me if I see it that way. Or if I don't protect myself. how do I build this identity again? I know I was talking about the sand pile, but can I consciously choose things that feel uncomfortable to build myself differently? You know, it's like I have blueprints that were born within me, these genetic blueprints, you know, and I have these things that are intrinsically part of my upbringing, you know, my parents, my environment, you know, nature versus nurture, you know, and then versus what actually happens. Who did I turn out to be? You know, all of our parents, and if you're parents now like I am, you have intentions for your children as our parents had intentions for us. That ideal of who I was going to be and who I am, there's a mighty huge distinction between the two. And how do we use our memories to reinforce this concept of what I am? You know, I've already discussed in several other podcasts how little I distrust. I have little faith in my memory. It's a very beautiful plaything, and I'm the most nostalgic person in my friend group, and I love to share stories of things that I think I remember, but I know that they're never perfect carbon copies of the actual happenings. But memory is crucial in the identity. A lot of the times I'm comparing what I'm doing now to a time that I thought I did well. Or sometimes I'll come up to a circumstance that I will encounter where the last time I encountered it, I didn't do so well. And that shadow hangs over the back of me as I approach this new conquest, this new opportunity of struggle. What is a group? Like, what makes it a group? It's loose ties of people or none. I want you to think of the onion of groups. Consider an onion, you cut it in half, you see all the layers. And the very inside of the onion, there is a central hub. Essentially, I think that's the essence of I. Within that, there maybe be nothing. Maybe behind the sense of I is a nothing. Behind the watcher, there could be nothing. But building on another layer, that would be, you know, for me, it would be my family, my son. And my son first, then my bigger family, then my extended family, you know, aunts, uncles, whatever. You know, but then my friends, probably, most of my friends are probably more important than some of my extended family members, you know? You have workmates that you have to be in group with, you know? You have your neighborhood. You have the people that live around you, or the people that live in your town, or the people that live in your county, or the people that live in your state, or the people that live in your country. Or perhaps, if you have a big enough heart, the last layer of your onion could encompass the people that live this world and all the people that aren't people that depend on this world just as much as we are, such as the blades of grass and the flighty bee picking pollen from flower to flower. All of these are groups, but it's like a bunch of circles, some bigger circles, some little circles, all intersecting in a bizarre just arrangement, quadrillions of different connections in different groups. You know, you could have you ever had that weird feeling when you hang out with one other person, you hang out group. Like I was always really good with like one other person because I wouldn't have to split my attention and give all my attention to my friend, and I could go hang out with somebody else. But you know, one-on-one was always best for me when I was growing up. And then as we got older, group phenomena, you know, parties start to happen, group, you know, and I remember getting so uncomfortable when I was younger, having to go to group things. I hated going to dances, you know, just because it was so overwhelming for me. And I always had this weird thing where I hang out with your best friend and then like another one of your friends that you're really close with. And like, you can hang out with each of them separately and you're fine, but you hang out in a trio and it just feels so weird, you know, like that's like almost like two groups, but I'm part of both of those groups. So is my other friend. The other person's only part of one group. No, you know, like, so there's so many different ways that we make these groups and these intersections with the people in our lives. But I would hazard to say that every single mote of life on this planet deserves the attention and compassion if you're able. And if you're aware of it, it makes it easier. I tried to look up a rough history of the concept of self. I know that mental health as an idea is only a couple hundred years old. But arguably, we've been conceiving of souls and a separation of the body going back thousands of years, if not to the beginning of time, which makes me think that even a bee has a concept of self. You know, Plato and Aristotle and all those, they were talking about souls, and they had different, they were, had anatomies of souls with different parts. Aristotle's soul, there was the vegetative soul. You know, plants have a soul, but they don't move, and all they do is grow, vegetative growth. You know, they obtain food and they produce. Whereas an animal soul doesn't have the will that a human soul has, you know, so like they had different variances of souls that could go into different life. And this was in 500 BC, which was, you know, 2,500 years ago. Not a new idea. And we're still thinking about it with almost as much assurance of what we're thinking about as they did had. Mirror neurons and empathy. Have you ever heard those terms? I love the idea of the mirror neuron, and I'm going to go through it gently, you know, and I'm going to try not to patronize. If you already know, we're just going to reinforce a couple things. So within our brains, which is the physical hardware, which we're dependent upon, within our brains, there are neurons that have been shown to fire when somebody else's fires. Which, like, and it gets, it's more complex than that. Like, if you have a feeling, like when you're watching a scary movie, there's a feeling inside you where you're, where you are identifying with the person who might be getting hurt, and that's part of the thrill, you know. And then there's the acknowledgement of, oh, thank God I'm not getting hurt, which makes you feel better, you know. But they had this, the science-y experiment done a while ago where they had a person in a room, and they had like electrodes attached to them. And then they had another person outside the room, and the person couldn't see them. And then they gauged the reaction when they'd get shocked. And then one, I think one, like, and so they would gauge the reaction of the person watching the person getting shocked. And when they get hurt, the person who's not getting shocked feels the pain. And once they've seen it, it becomes a lot less likely that they'll hit a button to shock the other person. Because once you feel another person's pain, it's harder to put them through that, which is one of the other confounding yet useful and necessary pieces that empathy allows us to do. And I don't think empathy is a human attribute. You know, dogs will sacrifice themselves for their owners. You know, we, compassion is not a human attribute either, but the opposite of compassion, you know, abstract capitalism is not human. It's not natural. I digress. If anything, you can probably see that I have a bone to pick with society, not the people in society, just the webs of games that we have to play, that we all have to play. It's been a rough couple weeks. I'm not too happy with these games right now, if you can't tell. So, just to end off, I wanted to get into a little bit of just kind of religious ideas. When I was considering this topic, one of the things that kept coming up to me was my upbringing. You know, I was born in Tennessee, and in Tennessee, you are the minority if you're not Christian. Most people, when I was growing up, were part of the church. And if you wanted to have friends, you had to go to church groups, you know, like, because that's where your friends were. So, you know, I had a negative feeling about it for a long time. And this antipathy made me veer towards strict non-spirituality and just atheism for a while, where I just wanted to call everything bullshit. And then I migrated that everything's bullshit to maybe we're just bullshit. And then if we're just bullshit, why can't we have gods if we feel better? If we can have a God that makes my life a little bit better, even if I don't ever, that's fine. Who gives a shit at that point? So within Christianity, there's this emphasis, at least, that I always felt on my personal soul. You know, the essence of who I was born with it, you know, and according to Christianity, my soul was born bad because the first people that were ever invented turned out to be bad because, according to the Bible, Eve goes, gets the forbidden fruit. Snake talks her into it. But she still takes it of her own volition. Then she goes back and talks Adam into eating it. From then on, they have to wear clothes. Sin is born. That's the minute they accept sin. From that point on, all of their children were born sinners, according to, you know, the Bible. So I was born bad, according to this belief system, which is just, it's a hard thing to carry as a young man, a young little boy, you know? Like, I was always mindful and aware enough to realize that I made decisions that I didn't like, that I was mean to others, and it made me feel guilty and bad when I hurt others. And you can be the most aware person in the world and still hurt somebody else, you know? A bad day can have huge impacts, even if you're a very good person. And I was aware of this even as a small child. And I would carry with me just incredible guilt because I was born this way, according to this belief system that I was almost born into. You know, my dad was not Christian, but my grandparents were. And like I said, everybody around us was. So it was either that or the highway, you know. So salvation comes from asking for forgiveness, you know, and trying to be the best you can. So all of the responsibility for the tortured soul that's born into this world completely depends upon my personal actions. And that weight as a child just fucked me up, you know, just so bad. You know, maybe it's not all Christianity. Maybe this is just how it was approached to me and how I felt. But still, you know, it was traumatic to have all that weight put on the shoulders because of a God that I was supposed to depend on for my afterlife, which is going to be the all of eternity, because my little short life was nothing compared to an immortality in heaven or hell, you know, and that awful depiction of what hell is. So there's such an individual, this, like, if we go back to what we've been discussing the whole episode, you know, the super individualist, the hardcore selfish person that doesn't consider the group, whether they're part of it or not, you know, the way that Christianity was approached to me in my childhood is like the ultimate individualist belief system where you depend upon yourself and your actions only. Whereas one that I have found recently and I've been approaching is Hinduism, where I read the Bhagavad Gita recently, and I read the Dhammapada, which is the words of Buddha and Buddhism, which they're very closely tied. You know, and this is a drastically different belief system. And I'm no Hindu, you know, I'm no anything. I'm not sure if I'll ever be anything except just this loose bundle of ideas I've idiosyncratically picked that soothe me and that I feel okay about. But there's things that I find appealing in Hinduism, especially with my roots from this very individualistic spiritual center. Within Hinduism, Brahma, everything is one. You know, and the para-atma, the soul that resides in me or in you, there's two souls. There's the atman, which is the individual sense identity. But some would argue that when you transcend past that and go into impersonal Brahma, you would lose that atma and you would just remember your para-atma. You'd remember that everything is one and it was all an illusion that made me think that I was anything different from you. Which is, when I look at you, I see the love that's in me is the love and it's in you. You know, and I don't believe in Brahma or God, but I can take that and use it to grow my ability to be more compassionate because it makes me more empathetic to see everybody as I see myself. If I can care for others as much as I care for myself, then that makes me better in my mind. I feel better about being me, you know? And I just see such a big difference between the collective soul, where we all share, we all are one soul and the illusion of self, versus, you know, these all of the separate souls fighting for salvation. You know, I'm not trying to make one sound better than the other. I guess this is incredibly biased. I hope that does not offend you. I think that Christianity is a wonderful belief system. I love Jesus. I personally think he was a cynic philosopher, but the words of Jesus and much, even though the Old Testament had a lot of brutal rules and a lot of just really archaic shit, there's still a lot of good stuff about loving your neighbor, not harming others, focusing on well-being. There's a part in Leviticus where they, because I read the Bible, there's a part in Leviticus where they're clearly describing how to treat leprosy and how to take people with leprosy and how to dispose of them and burn them so that it would help diffuse from the contagion spreading to other people. And this was 2,000-3,000 BC, where it was very, very rare for, I'm sure, for this kind of germ theory and at least, you know, washingness and all that kind of stuff to be happening. Cleanliness and all that. That kind of stuff wasn't even very popular until like the late 18, 1700s. Not even after that, probably 1900s. Don't quote me. I'm not a medical scientist. But my point is that there's valuable things in the Bible. Christianity is a valid belief system. I'm just commenting on the individual aspects of Christianity versus the collectivist group aspects of Hinduism. You know, and there's various religions in between, and then there's no right way to be. Yeah, I got a little nasty with my history there, but I love Christians. I talk to Christians every day, and I want you to know that if you're Christian, that I approve and respect you. Please. Yeah, don't want to be a bastard. I come across as a judgmental bastard sometimes, but I swear that I'm not as judgmental as I sound. Anyways, this is going to be the end of my rant. I had a good time doing this episode. I've been thinking about it for a while. I don't think I'm all the way there yet. I was doing a little bit of research before I recorded, and you know, there's definitely a lot of other things. So we might touch back again. I might reapproach some of these topics the more I read about them, if I can build some more information and have different ideas. Maybe we can have some part twos in the future on subjects such as fairness, you know, work, individuality, collectivism. We're gonna do something on love soon. Yeah, I talk about love enough. You know, I'm going to keep putting material, and I hope it helps. I appreciate you so much. I'm so grateful for your ears and your attention. If you have been listening to me for a time now, thank you. You are so important. You are a valuable individual self within the group collective that you are part of. You are loved, and you have the ability to love. And that is so impressive, because you are an impressive, impressive, competent human. And you're beautiful. Whether you're a man or a woman, you're beautiful. I hope you know that. All right. If you want to talk, if you want to ask some questions about the topic today, or if you have any ideas for future topics, or if you would just like to have a conversation about anything, I'm always available to talk. You can find me on Facebook. At the Gingerbread Man. I think my handle is the Gingerbread Man Dialogues. You can message me there, or you can email me directly at my personal email, which is Brandon with an O, Brandon WVOGT at gmail.com. I swear, I will try to do anything I can to help or educate myself. If you have wonderfully valid informative facts for me, maybe we can make an episode together. Either way, thank you so much. And now I'm going to pass it along to Odin. Hope you have a wonderful week. Hi, everybody. This is our segment, Ask O. And here's my special correspondent, Mr. Odin. You want to say hi?
Hi!
So today's question is, what does I mean? Not like the eyeball, when you say that I want that, who is I?
I is a letter, and everybody, I have a I in my name.
You do have an I in your name, but other than the letter, what about you? You know how I, you know how we use it to speak for ourselves?
Oh, yeah. Like my name is Odin, and I like, you can hear the I. I hear the I.
Yeah, and that's when you're expressing yourself, right?
Yep.
You're talking about you?
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell me more about that? What do you think other people's eyes are like? Other people use I too, don't they?
Yes.
Okay.
Names.
Mm-hmm. And they also have feelings too, right?
Yeah. Like I feeling sad.
Mm-hmm.
I hear the I.
Mm-hmm. And they see all kinds of cool things and everybody. So if somebody sees the same thing and they see it from a different place, don't they see something a little bit different than you?
Yes.
Don't they feel a little bit differently?
Yes.
Now how about groups of people?
Ooh.
How do you think eyes work when you have a whole bunch of eyes?
I don't know.
Try. What about when you're at school in your group? How do you feel when you're in a group of people? Do you think differently?
I think crazy.
Tell me about it.
I think crazy.
Why crazy?
Because I hear the I, because I said I, you hear the I.
Mm-hmm.
I.
Tell me about it.
Oh.
Do you think differently in class than when you're by yourself?
Oh, yes. I'll be sad if everybody is not at class, only me. Mm.
What if you're thinking differently than your class? What if you think something and everybody else thinks something different?
I'll be just be quiet.
Oh, yeah? How does that make you feel?
Sad.
Yeah? But you know it's okay, right?
Yep.
You know it's completely okay to think differently than everybody else, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Anything else you want to talk about? Something cool you saw today?
Yeah, I will. In Minecraft, I was made a giant treehouse and then blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah?
Yes!
Is that a kind of monster? A blah, blah, blah monster?
No, it's not!
Are you sure? Is it made of carrots?
Dad, pause the video.
We're almost done. You want to say bye?
No, I had to. It's about. I can't see it.
Yeah?
I'll find out. I'll say it in this release.
Oh. Yeah? Okay. You want to say bye to everybody?
Nope.
Nope? Okay. Well, bye, everybody. Have a wonderful week.
No! No! No!